Unlock your Bible. Discover the true meaning of life. Learn the cause of world problems and the astounding solution. Prove for yourself what the future holds. In the Trumpet Literature Library, you will find answers to life's most important questions. Explore these vital titles on Trumpet Bookshelf.
Welcome to Trumpet Bookshelf. I'm your host, Grant Turgeon. We're broadcasting to you live from the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus in Edmond, Oklahoma this morning, February 8th. It's brutally cold outside. I think it's under 20 degrees right now. But I think our radio antenna is now working, unlike yesterday, for those of you listening in the local area. Today we're covering the final two chapters of the Child Rearing with Vision book. This is a new book available at thetrumpet.com. And I also want to announce to you now that we will be speaking with Mr. Dennis Leap next Friday at 10 a.m. Central Time on this show. He had a big role in compiling and writing this book, and so he'll tell us some of his thoughts on that. So set your calendars, mark your schedules, set an alarm if you have to make sure that you listen into that, because he has a lot of wisdom to offer on this vitally important subject. Chapter 7 of this book is titled Prepare Teens for Adulthood, and this is taken from the late theologian and educator Herbert W. Armstrong's book, The Missing Dimension in Sex, chapter 13. So what I did today actually was set up a goal to take away from each of these last two chapters of the book. And so hopefully that gives us a really clear purpose and objective to focus on in each chapter. Let's look at 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14 for the goal, you could say, of chapter 7, which, again, is prepare teens for adulthood. 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 14. Be you not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communion has light with darkness? Mr. Armstrong here in this chapter is talking about dating and marriage and how converted Christians and those in God's church should be mixing with other Christians and with other people in the church. So that means dating within the church, marrying within the church. So taking away from that scripture here, our goal, as parents, we want to prepare our children for marriage one day, especially as they advance through the teenage years and into college and beyond. We want to make sure we lay the right foundation for children within God's church to become adults within the church, our families producing families, and on and on and on it goes. Isn't that really the God family vision in action? To have families producing more families, every family with the whole purpose of glorifying God and replicating the God family within their homes. That's obviously something that we want all of our children to do one day. We hopefully can set a great enough example for them so that they end up following it when they get older. Now, mommies listening in today, brace yourselves for what I'm about to say. Don't cry, or if you're going to, take a moment to get a box of tissues. Your children will leave home one day. That is going to happen. Mr. Armstrong considered children to be children until about age 20 because of some statements in the Bible. So 18 to 20, that's around the range where ideally our children can move out of the house, perhaps attend Herbert W. Armstrong College if possible, and start really building toward setting up their own families. My mom is really worried about my younger brother leaving the home. He's the last of our four, he's the last of the four of us siblings. And whenever he's gone, my parents are going to be what they call empty nesters. My mom's already worried about that. he'll be gone out of the house in just a few months. But of course, we know that there is a lot of beauty in that too. As Mr. Armstrong points out here as well, the vital preparatory years are between the ages of 16 and 25. He talks about dating. This is on page 173 of the Child Rearing with Vision book. Again, this is taken from Mr. Armstrong's book, The Missing Dimension in Sex. So page 173, it's talking about how God selects our husband or our wife. God is the one who chooses who we marry, as long as we're submitting to Him. And that really is a great lesson to teach our young people, especially as they go up through their teenage years. They're going to hit physical maturity many years before they hit full mental and emotional maturity. And we have to make sure that they have the right focus in mind here. It is really an uncertain time, especially as you move out of the house and perhaps you start looking for a future spouse. But really, if we understand that God is in charge of that selection process, it really does help us to go into it with a lot of relaxed faith. Obviously, dating within God's church, dating God's way, is very different from dating in the world. A few years ago, I tried to explain to some distant relatives how we date at the college here, and I told them that I've dated every single girl at the college several times, at least, if not more. And they were just in utter shock by that, because obviously in the world that would mean something very different. It's not an uplifting, upbuilding experience for the most part out in the world. But dating is supposed to be an enriching experience. It's supposed to be done with people of like mind. It's meant to build each other up in conversation, in uplifting activities. And this is something that we can prepare our teenagers for, having group dates when they're still teens. And then, of course, when they leave the home, maybe come to college here, they'll be able to date within the college. And when they're baptized, they can date other baptized members of the church. But dating is not always supposed to be a serious pairing off or going steady, as Mr. Armstrong put it. Dating is a great way to get to know people before that stage. And so we have to make sure, as parents, that we're helping our teens prepare for that very soon after they move out of the house. Page 180 of the Child Rearing with Vision book talks about these preparatory years. Again, that's ages 16 through 25. And this isn't just a time where maybe they learn about group dating or they start to date God's way in college and out of the home. It's also a vital time for adult preparation for life's work, as Mr. Armstrong says. This is page 180, Mr. Armstrong writing. During these years, the mind is capable of acquiring, faster than at any other stage of life, the advanced knowledge needed before beginning one's adult career, whether it be business, profession, occupation, or marriage. Before age 16, the mind has not acquired the basic elementary knowledge needed as a foundation for entering more advanced study, and the mind has not developed in serious comprehension to the level of advanced knowledge. After age 25, the mind, which has stagnated since age 16, finds it difficult to enter upon more mature study. So ages 16 through 25, that's where we really begin our push toward adult maturity, preparing ourselves for life in the real world outside of the home. And of course, as parents, we want to make sure that our children are developing skills, are developing certain aptitudes and abilities, taking their education in school seriously, even educating themselves outside of school by reading good books, having valuable experiences. Because, of course, again, the goal is that our families produce families. We want strong families down through the generations, families built God's way. And this is a vital time, ages 16 through 25, teaching our teenagers, helping them set that right foundation. Obviously, the latter part of that period, 16 through 25, there's a good chance that our teenagers, our young people, are not living with us anymore. And that's why they need to have that foundation set for them while they're still under our roof. Mr. Armstrong talks about the best age for marriage. He writes that it's ages 24 through 26 for men and 23 through 25 for women. And he had a life full of experiences raising up his own college and counseling a lot of young people for marriage, showing them the right way to date. And from his experience, these were the best ages for marriage. Again, 24 through 26 for men and 23 through 25 for women. And I could say from my own experience, this is spot on accurate because I got married when I was 23. And sure enough, I'm 26 now, and I'm way better at this whole marriage thing than I used to be. It does take a certain amount of experience to get good at these types of things, a certain amount of maturity. And conversely, my wife was actually a little bit older than that. And she was already too good at marriage when we started. So I definitely had some catching up to do. There's another stage here of advanced maturity that Mr. Armstrong writes about. This is page 181 of the Child Rearing with Vision book. Again, you can find that for free at thetrumpet.com. Page 181. By age 30, the man or woman has added 5 years of practical experience in addition to further study to the preparatory knowledge and final reaching of mental maturity attained at age 25. Prior to 25, the young man is often called just that, young man, by older men. So age 25 is where you hopefully gain a lot of knowledge and preparation for life outside of your parents' home, life outside of college, starting your own career, building your own family. But then by age 30, you have so much more valuable real-life experience out there in the real world. And then a little bit farther down here on page 181, Mr. Armstrong writes, Jesus Christ, our example, did not begin his active ministry until age 30. All years prior to that were years of learning and preparation. So if even our Savior himself didn't hit that experience threshold until age 30, well, it's probably a good indicator that we could definitely benefit from that extra experience as well. And we'll cover a lot more of this information. This, again, is taken from the book, The Missing Dimension in Sex, and we'll cover it in a lot more detail in some later episodes about that book, too. So now moving on here to Chapter 8. This chapter in the Child Rearing with Vision book is titled Make Your Family Life Active. And like I did with Chapter 7, I'll give you a goal taken from Chapter 8, something that we can do to really be the best parents possible. This is a goal taken from Deuteronomy 6, verses 6 through 7. It states, "And these words which I command you this day shall be in your heart, and you shall teach them diligently unto your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up." So our goal from this chapter is to teach at every turn. Do so in a way that makes your children love God's way of life. Everything we do every day, there is a teaching opportunity that can come from it. This chapter is really brilliantly practical. It talks a lot about building fond memories that our children, when they are adults, can look back on. Memories of being taught how to work, being taught how to play, learning and being educated through travel. I look back on my childhood with a lot of fondness because of the effort and the sacrifice that my parents put in. I had the chance to travel the world and go to a lot of different youth camps and educational institutions that changed my life. These are memories that my parents helped to build for me. I learned work ethic by having my own small landscaping business when I was 13 years old. I'd go into the neighborhood across the street. Sometimes I'd have my mom drop me off. I wasn't even old enough to drive my equipment over there. And then I just mow 4 or 5 lawns in a day. And if I didn't have any jobs lined up at the time, I'd help out in the landscaping department or the mail processing department here on the Armstrong College campus where we are in Edmond, Oklahoma right now and where we're broadcasting from. There are always a lot of great opportunities to work. My father had me help him out in the garden or help him around the house if something needed to be fixed up. My parents put me in various sports leagues so that I'd learn how to be competent in some of these skills, and it's a great way to exercise and have fun with friends. We took some really great trips. One that stands out, my mom had a high school reunion up in Washington State, and we drove all the way up there from Oklahoma. We went through just beautiful parts of the country, Wyoming, Montana, Idaho. You had pretty much every type of scenery, every type of environment you can imagine, and just showed the glories of God's creation. And so many different fun things we did in our stops along the way on that trip. And that's really what we want to do for our children. Use our resources, take the time, expend the energy, put down the money to build these type of experiences in our children's lives. Make the sacrifices that it takes to make sure that our children, when they are old, look back on their childhood with an abundance of positive experiences. They should be able to look back on childhood with great joy and with great pride, knowing the love that their parents showed for them. They shouldn't look back at childhood and think, oh, I just had all these restrictions. I couldn't do anything I wanted. And that sometimes is a problem in the church. To a young child and even to a teenager, keeping the Sabbath every week might not seem like the most appealing option. Friday sunset to Saturday sunset, well, they can't play sports. They can't hang out with their friends from public school. Whatever it might be, they can't go to a game or whatever their friends are trying to invite them to do. And so isn't it our job as parents to show them a much better alternative, to teach them, to train them, to help them look forward to the Sabbath every week? And this chapter has great practical points on how to do that. The Sabbath doesn't have to be a burden for our children. Just because they might not understand as much of God's truth as we do as adults, our children can really look forward to the Sabbath in an abundance of small ways. If the Friday night meal is a special meal, which maybe the mother takes even longer to prepare than usual, if you just put out a candle, or if you put out special decorations on the table, if you provide dessert at that meal when you normally don't get it at other times of the week. If that meal is a feast-like meal, well, that's the start of the Sabbath for those kids, for our kids. They start to learn about the Sabbath and look forward to the Sabbath from the very first meal on the Sabbath day, that Friday night meal. And as parents, we could take time during the week to prepare various activities, basic Bible lessons according to our children's age. We can have loving discussions with them, spend time with them, help them have opportunities to spend time with other children in the church. The Sabbath should be a delight. That's what the Bible calls it. The Sabbath is a delight. And it doesn't just have to be a delight for the adults. We need to make sure that the children love it too. And it's not just the Sabbath dinner. What about every dinner? What about all the opportunities that we have to spend time with our children and to build love in our homes? There's a lot of practical instruction here just about spending time with our family, especially at the dinner table. Page 188 says, "But what a tremendous advantage has the family with an in-house educated nutritionist who is also a skilled cook. A woman who devotes herself to providing food that will truly nourish her family is a priceless treasure. Can you possibly measure the benefits in foregone sickness, increased energy, improved health?" So this is talking about having a home-cooked meal, hopefully getting together at least once a day as a family to share a healthy meal that the stay-at-home mom has prepared. There's no shame in being a stay-at-home mom. It doesn't matter what society says about it. It's such a huge benefit to every family. Page 188, a little bit farther down here, says, "This value is measurable. One Columbia University study found that teens in families that almost never eat together are 72% likelier than the average teen to use illegal drugs, cigarettes, and alcohol. Those who eat dinner with their parents fewer than three times a week are likelier to smoke and drink than those who eat with their parents six times a week." So again, this is an opportunity to establish a daily habit that will keep our kids out of jail, literally. And what's so bad about just sitting down as a family and taking that time? You know what? The screens will still be there after dinner is over. And maybe those should be limited a lot too. And that this chapter actually talks about that. So having a stay-at-home mom who prepares great meals, having the family get together every day for a good meal together, and not just eating together in silence or in front of the TV, but actually communicating. There's some great instruction here about having each member of the family bring a joke or a story or maybe some other topic from an article or a book they're reading and building a stimulating conversation over dinner. And the most important ingredient in these meals is love. And you can find that in Proverbs 15 and verse 17. What about parental involvement in academics? I'm a teacher at Imperial Academy, the K-12 school here on campus. And so I have the chance to sit in on faculty meetings for the school. And it always seems to come up that some kids struggle and really are way behind on their work, and maybe they're taking 4 or 5 hours to complete one assignment that other kids are finishing in 20 minutes. And really, parents can get involved with that, be proactive, make sure that they help their children with their homework, or make sure at least that children don't spend an inordinate amount of time on certain assignments. Parental involvement does help our children with their schooling. We can't really expect young children to be completely disciplined and focused on schooling unless we teach them that and help them with that. Conversation, not just at the dinner table, but all the time. Our children should deeply trust us. We should know our children, and we should also be sure that they know us. It says here on page 195, our children should be very comfortable talking and sharing with us. They should be more likely to discuss their problems and challenges with their parents rather than their peers. And that it's just, it's too easy sometimes for children to find people their age to talk to instead. But as parents, they should really be able, we should really be a reliable listener for our children. We should be an example to our children. We should teach them valuable skills. We should teach them important character traits. And these should be things that we have built into our own lives, not just things we expect our children to do while we live completely differently. And I'll just leave you today with an analogy. This is from page 196 of the Child Rearing with Vision book. If I can find that here. Oh, here you go. Your family is like a beautiful garden. It won't flourish by neglect, happenstance, and accident. It needs plenty of diligent work, attention, and care, watering, cultivating, pruning, weeding out wrong practices and habits, dressing and keeping it so it is a delight. Our families must be a delight, not a burden. They must be a shining example of God's way of life, and as parents, we have full control over whether that is the case. So today we've been summarizing chapters 7 and 8 of the Child Rearing with Vision book. Again, next week, next Friday at 10 a.m. Central Time, we'll be interviewing Mr. Dennis Leap about this book, which he had a big part in. Until next time, I'm Grant Turgeon. This has been Trumpet Bookshelf.
You've been listening to Trumpet Bookshelf. Please email your thoughts to comments at kpcg.fm. Listen for new episodes every Friday at 10 a.m. Central Time.